Hey, Dan.
What up, guy?
You're into this fintech. What's all this I'm hearing about Current?
You're going to like this, guy. Current is a fintech company that's completely disrupting traditional banking.
Wait a second. Does that mean I don't have to drive to the bank anymore?
Yeah, exactly. I manage an important part of my family's finances from one easy-to-use app.
Well, I got to get this app, but where can I learn more?
It's super easy. Just go to current.com/OK, O-K-A-Y, and download the app. That's current.com/OK.
Current is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group, member FDIC, and Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
Will M&A pick up in 2024? Will this year mark the return of IPOs? Listen to Strategic Alternatives, a podcast from RBC Capital Markets, to get fresh insights on the trends and market forces impacting deal flow across sectors and find out how companies and investors are preparing for potential surge in deal activity and what signals to watch for this year. Listen and subscribe to Strategic Alternatives, the RBC Capital Markets podcast today, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to OK Computer. I am Dan Nathan. I am joined by Deirdre Bosa. She is the host of CNBC's Tech Check. Debo, welcome back to the pod.
A pleasure as always.
Big show here today. We continue our Funders and Founders series. My good friend Katie Stanton of Moxie Ventures out of Boulder, Colorado, joins me with a really interesting CEO, a longtime Google product person turned founder. That's Jessica Ewing. She is the founder and CEO of Literati, a company she started almost 10 years ago. This is an Austin-based children's book subscription service. She's taken on some of the behemoths here and doing some really interesting stuff and with a really interesting mission towards literacy, as you can just imagine here, but a really interesting company. So stick around for that. That is the continuing Funders and Founders series brought to you by our friends at RBC Capital Markets. Debo, but you spent some time last week. I think they were calling it the NVIDIA Woodstock. I just couldn't believe what went on there. You were there for, I think, a couple of days in and out, had some great interviews. Claire Shih, she's the head of AI over at Salesforce. You had a long form sit down with her. We're going to put that in the show notes. What was just the takeaway from the vibe there? It just seemed pretty euphoric. One thing I said last week on the pod, because I was with Gene Munster here while you were over there, I think at the SAP Center here, and I guess it was the Moscone Center. It took over all of San Francisco. It really felt like take the last 10 product announcements from Apple, put them all together, and that's what you had last week in San Francisco.
So a lot of folks were calling it the Woodstock of AI, as you said. But here, a lot of people are calling it as well the new WWDC. That's, of course, Apple's like famous developers event that happens every year. And it kind of shows you like how times are shifting, right? It's been WWDC, or Dub, as it's called, has been like the biggest event in tech for the last decade. And this year, it just felt it's GTC, indisputably. Anyone who's anyone is going to be there and was there. I spoke to Claire Shih, who is the CEO of Salesforce AI, a few weeks prior at the Moscone Center, but of course she was there at the event, and it all like rolls into one, right? Just this excitement here in the Valley and outside of the Valley about AI, and every company wanted to be there because they wanted some of that NVIDIA halo effect. And if you weren't there, you're seen as not having an AI strategy. And even if you don't have a baked one, you had to be there to sort of bask in the halo that is Jensen Huang. And it was amazing. I was at this incredible panel discussion of the authors who wrote this like seminal paper on Transformers, which kicked off the whole ChatGPT Gen AI era. And it was moderated by Jensen Huang himself. And honestly, like, I've never felt so cool as I did as being walked to the front of that line and going in, because when I say that line was long, it wound all around the SAP center. Like, I couldn't even find the end of the line. That's how packed, three overflow rooms. Everyone just wanted to absorb as much information, as much Jensen Huang as possible.
As excited as people were about Apple and iPhone and every new whiz bang product that they came out with, and just, you remember this, and it really, sadly, I think the excitement in and around those events passed with Steve Jobs passing back in 2011. I mean, I think Tim Cook has, obviously, this is no comment on how he's operated this company, which has been absolutely phenomenal over the last, call it 12, 13 years since he took over. But when you think about the excitement in and around NVIDIA, just go look at the year to date. The stock is up 100%. It's gained $1 trillion in market cap. And so never in Apple's history did it ever double in such a short period of time in and around the excitement in the industries in which they were tackling and the product products that they were offering and the like. So that to me is what's different. Does that make some sense to you? And I'm just curious because when people used to line the streets to get into Moscone for WWDC and hear what the new iPhone was going to be or whatever the new product was, these were consumer products. These were developers who were creating apps that were going to go on them. So what's going on now is very different, right? Yeah, there's some commercialized products that people are using, but for search, but it's nothing mission critical like having a supercomputer in your pocket and dying to get the next one out. So I'm just curious, how do you grapple with that, this kind of enterprise focus that is clearly what's gone on with GTC, and especially when you look at all the announcements and all the companies were there versus what had gone on, let's say, in the prior 15 years with Apple?
That is such a great point. The iPhone is something that people could touch and use in their everyday lives, whereas new chips from NVIDIA go into your devices. The consumer doesn't have a really good understanding of everything that goes into it. And it is so much more complicated. But what I think GTC did this year, which is really important when we talk about the enormous gains NVIDIA has had versus the iPhone, is that Jensen Huang was able to illustrate NVIDIA as an ecosystem, not just a hardware company, not just the chips, but the whole ecosystem on which generative AI, which people do have a touch point to in ChatGPT and Gemini and these chatbots that more and more people are using. There's that sort of connection, which is hard to draw, but there's just a huge amount of enterprises. And I guess the market also understands that is very valuable. And it's not just about these chips, right? It's about NVIDIA entrenching its dominance.
Right. And again, there's been a lot of talk about the recurring nature of this CUDA software platform. The company has been working on this for 2 decades. They've applied it to all the different technologies that they've been using GPUs for. And even when they announced the new Blackwell chip, they announced a really cool thing that if you want to upgrade your H100s, you can subscribe per chip at 5,000 per on the software platform and everything like that,
yep.
Which I think is really interesting. I know you saw this story here. This was out of Reuters just a couple days ago. Behind the plot to break NVIDIA's grip on AI by targeting software, it's a focus on this one API that is backed by a whole consortium of mega tech companies. Intel and Qualcomm are two of them. And I'm just curious, again, these are two companies that are really, and if you look at some of the others, they're competing with NVIDIA. They're not partnered with NVIDIA, right? And so is this the sort of story that we're going to see catch some steam, or is it the sort of thing where it's just a bunch of also-rans trying to get in the game here and offer some sort of alternative to the only game in town at the moment?
The short answer is I'm not sure. But what I will say is that this has been a common story thread that has been being pitched to me by mega caps, startups alike over the last year, is the something to break NVIDIA's dominance. And nobody has been able to do that. Nobody's even come close. Maybe an AMD in the future, right? It's the only really name that I can think of. But I remember too, last year, sitting down with Adam Selipsky, the CEO of AWS, which is a key part of this sort of the new infrastructure. And they're developing their own custom in-house chips. And he was telling me how there's no difference between the chips they're creating and the GPUs that NVIDIA has. But some months later, people still want the GPUs from NVIDIA. So I don't know. I'm sure in some ways they're providing an alternative, perhaps a cheaper alternative, perhaps a more accessible alternative. But there's nothing that has come close to NVIDIA's dominance. These stories keep springing up, whether it's Intel, which you just pointed to. And I can't tell you the number of startups that are creating chips and software to compete or at least provide an alternative.
One of the things that is buoying the NASDAQ and I think investor sentiment in general is the broadening out of this trade, right? Despite the fact that NVIDIA has had this massive run over the last 3 months or so after a long consolidation between that kind of $400 and $500 range, it broke out at $500 in early January and it has basically doubled since then. But you're seeing companies like Dell that reported and guided up and they're talking about demand for their servers. You looked at Micron last week was up 25% alone for storage that is going into all of these servers and the like here.
ARM.
Yeah, and ARM.
It's funny, when I think about an ARM, when they went public last September, I remember calling them AI adjacent. They were trying to sort of have this like generative AI halo. It didn't happen until NVIDIA was like, actually, we need ARM CPUs to build the new accelerated computing infrastructure. And then it was off to the races. So it does work, but investors, I think, want to see a little bit more evidence. You can't just put a generative AI or an NVIDIA wrapper on something. They want to actually see how it works in the ecosystem that NVIDIA has created.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And this brings me to an article in the Information again just a couple days ago. A booming NVIDIA supplier says AI costs need to drop. This is Micron. Micron, an IBM executive, said AI costs need to drop to attract business customers. Executives said AI-focused phones and PCs will drive more demand, but some of the constraints in the data center power could limit growth. And so that has been another narrative. You and I have talked about that a bunch. We keep seeing more and more about that. That might become a story later on in the year. Again, if some of the end customers who've been spending $40,000, $50,000 for these GPUs and building data centers and the cost of compute, and the list goes on and on. But if they can't commercialize, if they don't see demand for the products, you know what I mean? At some point, you'll see a bit of a pullback. And I just think that's interesting coming from a Micron exec where they just saw a beat and raise that is not as eye-popping as to what we saw back in May from NVIDIA, but it is the sort of thing that gives you confidence for a stock that trades very cheap. It always has a very cyclical sort of name about continuing to own this name. And so I'm just curious, are you hearing more and more about that? If we don't see the products come ultimately, then we might see a dip in some of these shares, because the first quarter that NVIDIA is to guide down, that is going to be a seminal event, I believe, in this AI and the AI adjacent trade in the public markets.
So I think there's two things. Everyone is saying basically AI costs need to drop. That is what NVIDIA is working on as well, but also the energy needed, right? The power behind the processes. And one of the common themes from GTC was the idea that like generative AI and these models need to become more efficient. They're using huge amounts of compute power to do something as simple as 2 + 2. It needs to learn when to use a simple calculator, when to use the algorithm that also answers really complex answers. So I think that's like kind of the next thing that needs to happen. That was what a lot of folks were talking about. But in terms of like the companies also trying to make products and monetize those products in generative AI, the Information again did a really good analysis of the costs involved. And I think that the multiple is very different and the margins are very different than even software companies. So there is still that divide in the fact that it takes more to run a generative AI company that is using large language models than it does for like your average software company of the last 5 years.
So let's talk about the IPO market here a little bit, because again, one of the things that's interesting when you think about like a market that's broadening out a little bit, again, we listed some of the stories that are AI adjacent or they're working into the fold here, but there's also a demand for kind of some new stories here. Like some of them are fairly well picked over, as we know, in the public markets. There was two deals last week. I know that you probably took a close look at this Astera. And then there was one Reddit, which I love this. Casey Newton said in his platform, former note, that the IPO is more of a lifetime achievement award for this 18-year-old company finally going public. They're getting their financials in order. They're getting their costs in order at a time where if they didn't have some of the revenue that they're talking about, like basically selling the data, you know, through their API for all sorts of AI mining, if you will, Google was the big one. I think Alphabet at $60 million with a couple more announced. This would just not be that interesting of a story right now. And it may not be an interesting story in 6 months or so, but what's your take as far as what are you hearing? There's lots of rumblings. You got a NASDAQ at all-time highs. You have the S&P all-time highs. It seems like this is probably a pretty good environment to come public, especially if you haven't dusted off that S1 from a year or two ago. You might think about doing it just about now.
Yeah, especially the combination of Reddit and Astera and then Trump's SPAC today. What are you waiting for? And I love the idea that Reddit was a lifetime achievement award. When I go back to like the first wave of recent IPOs, that was last fall, you had Arm and Instacart and Klaviyo. You could call Instacart like a lifetime achievement award as well. It had been private for, I believe, 10 years or more than 10 years, somewhere around there. And it missed the wave of IPOs in 2020, 2021, when you saw Airbnb and DoorDash go public, and it hasn't done all that well. And then you have a Reddit, which I think has like a less appealing probably financials and proposition than in Instacart in a way, and it's to the moon, as they say. So have to see how this settles out, but it does feel like a very good time. In terms of that licensing revenue, right? Reddit gets the majority, north of 95% of its revenue from advertising. Investors need to be careful reading into that licensing. Sure, it could be a new revenue stream. I think that when the CEO, Steve Huffman, was on CNBC talking about it, he didn't go too far. He was a little cautious talking about it because we don't know what the data is worth yet. And that's such an open question for these large language models. And there was an instance a few weeks ago or months ago where Sam Altman played down the value of one particular source he had incentive to because the New York Times is suing him over their data. But I would just say it's still new. And as these models are developed, as they move into the inference stage, I don't know that is so sustainable.
Yeah, and I guess it's a great point. I just think for the time being, it's very high margin for a company like Reddit that last year had $800 million in sales and they probably lost $91 million. And so when you think about just the cyclicality of advertising, you think of the cost structure that's probably still a little bloated for Reddit. This is a bit of a lifeline. So right now there's demand for this stock. And again, like all you have to do is go look at a Snap, which is really, I don't think ever on a GAAP basis made money since it went public in 2017. So I don't know when Reddit is expected to start making money, but not particularly interesting. But with $11 billion market cap, they do have cash. They have no debt. If you look at this SPAC from the DJT, this is the Trump thing. If you think about karma for that ticker, that company went bankrupt. That was a casino company that he owned 20 years ago. This is like the perfect Ponzi scheme, if you think about it. I mean that seriously, because there are so many incentives that just align directly to Donald J. Trump for this thing. This company had $3 million in revenue last year. It's losing lots of money, and it exists for one reason and one reason alone, to basically create a windfall from his fans or cult followers or whatever you want to call them to help him get out of the legal troubles. That's my two cents. I'm not asking you to kind of opine on that, but that's a fact. This is not a particularly interesting ongoing concern. There's no advertisers there unless you're advertising for guns, gold, money, and survival tools. I just think it's kind of interesting that now has nearly a $10 billion market capitalization and no meaningful revenue.
I just can't believe we're back in a SPAC era. Yeah. Investors learned that lesson such the hard way in 2022. And here you have another SPAC. Like, memory is so short. In terms of it feeling like 2021 all over again, or boom times, the story that I was reporting on today was Adam Newman's bid for WeWork. Everything is back again. A source confirmed to me that he's trying to raise up to $900 million to buy back the company, which is in bankruptcy proceedings. And it's just kind of unbelievable. You think, who's going to invest in Adam Newman after what happened at WeWork? And the answer is like someone out there. There's an Andreessen Horowitz that poured $350 million into his latest real estate startup called Flow. So it's just feels like wild times in markets again, private and public.
All right. So Deba, one last question here. So we just talked about obviously this limited sort of IPO market. We know that a lot of valuations in the AI space and the private markets have gotten a bit hairy, if you will. If everything that's old is new again, we could fully expect this to continue to go for a while. I'm just curious, when you're at an event like GTC, there's lots of folks from the private tech space there. There's obviously, it looked like dozens and dozens of representatives from all the name brand public tech companies here. What's just the vibe in general here? Does it feel like we're inflecting, or does it feel like we're getting to the death rattle and there should be some sort of pullback in both public and private markets, at least on the valuation front, because it feels like the euphoria level has been turned to 11.
I was at a dinner at a CNBC TEC Council dinner last week, and my guest was Vinod Khosla, like legendary investor. And I asked him that question. I said, where are we right now? Is it 1997 or is it 1999? He said, first of all, it's 1995. There's still so much ahead. And he goes, he brought up a really interesting point, because this question is asked a lot, I know, especially on our air. He said, it doesn't really matter, because even though the air will be taken out of some of the companies, especially the speculative ones, the ones with no revenue, et cetera, the internet still went on to be this huge disruptive giant force. That did not stop. And I thought that was an interesting point. So you did have every single gen AI, every AI company under the sun at GTC, but there was a few that stood out, like Anthropic, Mistral, which has the open source AI model. And these were the events that were like very packed. And some of the other ones under the radar, it seems to be this understanding that they may simply be wrappers, even though they can attract lots of funding. But really, I mean, in the private markets, it's a bifurcation still. You still see a lot of money headlines every day, pitches every day for companies raising hundreds of millions of dollars, it feels like, in the AI space. So I think that it's still very hot.
Let me just make one point there. And so what's different about now in the late 90s is just the amount of capital that's being allocated towards the private markets by VC, where that money is coming from, and the time in which like they can wait to go public. We're still waiting for Stripe to go public here, right? This is a company that was last valued at $45 billion. At one time, it was valued at $90 billion 3 or 4 years ago. And so I think what's interesting, they've had so much money thrown at them, not just from the VCs, but also from strategics. There might not be any push anytime soon for these companies to come to market. And what that does is place more scarcity value on the public companies that are out there. So when you ask the question about, are we 97 or 99 or 2000, one of the things is for a lot of the folks who like to use that term bubble, it doesn't mean like when you use that, there's not a direct negative connotation that it's about to burst and you're going to go into a multi-year bear market. It means that it can continue to inflate. And so to me, if a lot of those companies, unlike the companies in the late 90s that were pre-profit coming to market, if they decide to stay private for longer, that actually gives more scarcity value to the public companies in the NASDAQ. And so it could continue to go on for a whole heck of a lot longer. So again, I love that you asked that question. Let's continue to ask that question. I want to hear the answer every single time, especially from people like Vinod Khosla, because he's been there, he's done it, he's seen all the different cycles over the last 40 years or so. Debo, I really appreciate the debriefing here. I hope you'll come back next week. I can't wait to talk to you again about what's going on. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Dan.
All right. Stick around for my conversation with Katie Stanton and Jessica Ewan.
Hey, listeners, it's Dan here. I want to tell you about a company that I'm really excited about. It's called Current. It's a fintech company that's completely disrupting traditional banking. I'm a new Current customer. It's already helping me and my entire family manage our finances, all from one easy-to-use app. So try Current for yourself and get the app by going to current.com/OK. That's current.com/OK.
Current is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group, member FDIC, and Cross River Bank, member FDIC. In today's hyper-fast markets, it's never been more important to consider every option to raise capital, drive growth, and create value. Stay one step ahead with Strategic Alternatives, a podcast from RBC Capital Markets. In this season, RBC's experts will examine how corporates and investors are evaluating their strategic plans, reassessing their portfolios, and reallocating capital to help them lead today and define tomorrow. Tune in to Strategic Alternatives, the RBC Capital Markets podcast today.
I am joined with someone that you guys know from OK Computer past episodes. That would be Katie Stanton. She is the founder and general partner at Moxie Ventures in Boulder, Colorado. Katie, welcome back to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. Good to see you.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting series, and I know you and I have been chatting a little bit about it. I've gone out to some of my really good friends in the VC community and say, hey, listen, we have this really cool series. It's Funders and Founders. We want to talk about the relationship between some VCs and some early stage investments and some founders that they just find really interesting. They find their missions really interesting. They've evolved with the stories as investors. And then, and you said to me, I got somebody for you. It's Jessica Ewing. She is the founder and CEO of Literati. So Jessica, welcome to the pod.
It's great to be here, guys.
We have a lot to talk about because when Katie and I first met in 2021, a good friend of ours, mutual friend Sally Shin, said, I got somebody, if you want to do a tech pod, you got to start doing it with Katie Stanton. And of course, I go to the podcasting app and I look up Katie and I go to hashtag angels and I listen to a pod that you guys did together back then. I was like, okay,
I did listen to that.
This was 3 years ago, and I said, Katie's got chops, and I know everybody I know in the tech community, they know her and love her as an operator. Now she's becoming a VC, or you already had become a VC and started Moxie. And so that pod was really great for me to listen to. So here we are, 3 years later, and we're all potting together. So Katie, I'm just going to give you the mic here because I want to hear how you guys got to know each other because it goes way back.
It does go way back. And I'm a little bit scared about how way back that goes, but never mind. So I was very lucky and worked very hard to get this job at Google in 2003. And the class of product managers there was truly exceptional. I knew it at the time, but now looking backwards, it was Sundar Pichai, Brett Taylor, Susan Wojcicki, Marissa Meyer, Sukhinder Singh, Omid Kordestani, and Jessica Ewing, and all these amazing people. And the class was really fantastic. Everyone was top of their game, excited, knew how to build. And I was lucky enough to work with Jessica on a couple of products, including one Google and Google Finance. And everyone was smart at Google. Jess was smart, but had this bright light and just other extra things about her. For example, I remember going to a party. I think this was at Marissa's house, and everyone's having a nice time. And all of a sudden you hear somebody playing Beethoven on the piano. And I look over and there's Jess just playing away like a concert pianist. And I was like, what? You can play the piano too? Is there anything you can't do? And so that always stuck in my mind until fast forward years later, Jess had told me that she was going to write a novel. Of course she's going to write a novel. What else does somebody do post-Google? And then fast forward a few more years, she came up to me and told me that she's actually going to start a company. It's going to be a book club for kids. And I'll be honest, my initial reaction was like, okay, Jess, you're really smart, but that might be the stupidest idea. Have you heard of Amazon? Have you heard of these other products? But there's something about Jess. And I was like, I would like to invest. And I think I was one of your first angel checks.
It was a little bit like, okay, I was working on a novel. You're right, Katie. And then wanted to build again. I wanted to build a company. What am I most passionate about? Books, right? And what is like one of the categories that VCs are least excited about funding? Books, particularly print books. And the early days of seeking venture capital were, let's just say, challenging and interesting. But I also learned a lot in that process. I remember calling you and hearing that you were doing some angel investing. And I remember specifically, Katie, because this gets really interesting into early stage ventures and bets and exactly what you said. But I remember calling you and learning that you were in Vegas for the weekend. And I was like chatting with you on a Sunday. And I was like, oh no, like I'm chatting with someone and she's in Vegas. She's probably lost a lot of money. I'm going to like pitch the children's book club to Katie. It's going to be a disaster. Then I remember getting on the phone with you and you said the most heartening thing to me right out the gate. And you just said, it was so lovely. You were just like, are you kidding? You're like, a bet on Jess is better than any Vegas odds that I could possibly hope to get. And I was like, that's really sweet. And then you're like, and then what are you doing with this book club? We're figuring it out. But yeah, it was definitely an interesting start.
Just talk to us a little bit about the inspiration, because again, as Katie reminded you back then, that there was this online retailer that had books covered here, but it seems like you had a slightly different mission in mind. And one of the things, as I've gotten to know Katie and her partners and the portfolio companies and the founders, a lot of them are really mission driven.
Yeah, I mean, the mission of the company for Literati, and I'll let Katie speak to her how she views this, but the mission of the company is very simple. It's to ignite a love of learning and a love of life. That's what we do. And we do that in so many different forms. We do that in book clubs, which is where we started. We now have expanded into school book fairs. We have an e-commerce platform that we're using for schools. So the product has taken so many different forms, you know, and we'll get to that, because I think very few entrepreneurs, as even the best ones, know exactly how their business model is going to change over time. But the mission of the company is and was remains to ignite a love of learning and a love of life. You guys asked me a very good question, which is books as a commodity. Sure, books as a commodity you can get in a million different places. What I saw missing at the time that I was just getting started was that feeling of magic. I've always loved books, that feeling of magic that when you walk into a bookstore and feel that sense of wonder, that sense of excitement, of the world's knowledge is at your fingertips. How do you take that and create that feeling and that sort of excitement and that exciting shopping experience for someone who's 3 years old, 5 years old? How do you create a product that evokes that for an audience that young? And sure, their parents can buy books on Amazon, but that's not really the point. The point is, how do we create a novel and interesting shopping experience? And what we found success with out the gate was building sort of an innovative try before you buy book club, which is really where we started, where we sent artwork and stickers and all this cool stuff that made the box feel personalized to each kid. The box came in a, you know, a teal box, and we wanted to just make it feel really magical. And that's something that we find so many parents are trying to instill an intrinsic love of learning and the love of reading in their kids, because there's reading scores and there's test scores and there's all of that stuff. But the kids who do best, you know, and this has been well documented, are the ones that read and learn for for pleasure and have an intrinsic motivation to learn. And so that's the piece that I feel needs to be instilled from the youngest ages. You're not going to get that from an Amazon or a commodity product. It's just, it's a very different thing.
So I totally agree with all that. And I'm going to show you, which unfortunately everyone else here can't see because it's the podcast, but we accidentally received a Highlights magazine that I'm showing to the folks here. And I remember that joy of receiving a monthly Highlights magazine. And this went to the wrong house, so we're going to have to go down the street and give it to our little neighbors later today. But the joy that you talk about is really important. And I think the discovery of that content is really important. And you think about online discovery is really the nut to crack. It's on Netflix or Hulu. What should I watch? It's on Google or Net-a-Porter. What should I wear? And on books, it's what should I read? How do you share the discovery of reading? What's sort of the magic secret sauce to allow literati customers to know what they should be reading?
I agree with you, Katie. I think discovery is really a challenge. I think Amazon's a great place to go when you know exactly what you want to buy and you dial it in and you search for it. How do you discover those next great reads? And especially as a parent, when you're catering to interests that aren't your own and you're trying to feed a steady intellectual diet to someone whose brain is rapidly changing and developing and you always want to be jumping on the next thing. We started out, all we did was we would go find these hidden gems. So we started out just going through thousands of books and we were just like, we only put the top 1%, 0.1% of books that came across our desk into this box. And we tried to find things that were off the beaten path, you know, unknown. And our customers love that about us. They were like, I would have never discovered this totally unique book. My kid has developed this totally intrinsic, like love of math or whatever, because of this counting book that you sent. It was so cool. So that's really where we started, was like, okay, what are the most fantastic books in the world? Because it's hard to break through. Like a lot of the books that parents buy their kids are either classics or books that they remember buying from when they were kids. And there's so much beautiful work being done in the kid-lit space. It's beautiful. Some of the best art. It's incredible what some of these authors and illustrators are doing. And it's just like, how does a parent have the time, Katie, to go through all that and pick out the gems? So we started out doing that. And then what was unique about our product was that we would send people 5 books and they would be able to try them for 2 weeks and then buy the ones they want and send the rest back to us. So the artfulness comes in with us as curators, us as designers, us creating a beautiful experience. Where the science comes in is when the data starts hitting our desk. So at this point, we have gathered over 10 million data points on kids' books and what kids like and they don't like. And that not just enables us to really double down on the books that are being kept and the books that are working, but it also allowed us to build in a personalization layer into our curative processes.
Jess, let's talk about how the business has changed over the last few years, because some of those trends that you just talked about as it relates to discovery, as it relates to curation and the like, it's funny, I see through the lens of my own kids, where during the pandemic, kind of stuck at home, they were all on their screens and a lot of parents were giving them that time, whether it was Netflix or TikTok or whatever. But then something really interesting happened in my household. Both of my kids, through TikTok, they got on BookTok, right? So that whole idea of discovery and curation and things were being suggested to them and they started reading a lot more. And I don't have the data, but I could just say anecdotally, that was a huge boon for them. And my 18-year-old right now, Ellie, she is reading Wuthering Heights and she is still reading Percy Jackson for the 6th time. You know what I'm saying? Those two books are on her side table. And I just think that's really interesting. Talk to us how you're using technology, how you're thinking about other platforms, how they are getting kids interested in reading and the like. Because to me, this is something that I've seen firsthand, but I only see it accelerating from here. And someone who's built this trust with your audience already, it seems like there's a great growth opportunity for you, especially because, again, you are kind of tapping into something that a lot of other folks are just maybe not that focused on right now. They're more interested in selling volume at this point.
The business has changed a lot. We kept building the book club throughout 2019. 2020, we saw a huge surge for all the reasons that you mentioned, which is pandemic, at home. You know, one thing I'll say about kids and books is that kids grow up in such a digitally native environment these days that they don't make really the distinction that we do between real life and digital life. They're very interwoven, I think, for a lot of kids. kids. Like if you see the way they interact with technology, it's much more seamless. And so I think that I certainly am not one of these people that is like, oh, we can't use screens and screens are bad and anything like that. I candidly grew up playing a lot of video games and like still love books, you know, so it's nothing like that. But when it comes to books, though, it's funny, like a lot of kids associate their devices with games and other things. And I see a lot of kids of all ages, but particularly little kids, if they're going to read a book, they don't think about ebooks in the same way that we do. They actually think, oh, I'm going to read a book. I'm going to go sit in the corner and read a book. Devices are for certain things. And then a lot of kids, particularly young kids, gravitate towards print. 95% of sales of kids' books, specifically 95% of revenue in that category is from print. You know, just a couple of interesting things there. As far as what we're doing, we saw a lot of power in what we were doing, but the next move for us really was to start figuring out how we could support schools and educators in schools because, you know, we were reaching parents that were already bought into reading is important, literacy is important. But if we wanted to make a bigger impact, we needed to start to think about how to partner with educational institutions. And so the perfect medium for us to go into that space was actually book fairs. And so here's another, again, large category that hasn't been changed or disrupted for decades, the school book fair. And once I started looking at the school book fair, I said, this is phenomenal from both a business and an impact standpoint. These are essentially pop-up bookstores that are operating inside schools. And we all remember them from our own childhood. They haven't changed that much. But how can we provide those and make those really exciting? So we took all of the tech and the tools and the AI and the data science and all of the things that we had built for a direct-to-consumer audience. And we started going into schools and using the same tech and platform, hosting book fairs in schools, which are events that run inside school property. And we do more revenue now in book fairs than we even do in book clubs. It has been the fastest growing channel that we've ever seen. And we're now reaching 1.5 million kids. And you asked a question, you know, through book fairs, that's a huge to us data science problem, right? Which is that, again, going back to the company, how do we ignite a love of learning and a love of life? There's an artfulness to that. And we certainly want our fair and our presence in schools to be fresh and new and exciting and interesting. And how do you get kids feeling that magic of the bookstore? And that is why we have an incredible creative director, an incredible art team that is figuring out how to make that experience artful and relevant. I'll give you guys a sneak peek. Our spring 2025 next year, we're actually doing something called the Story Arcade is our theme. And so the book fair is like a game theme. And so how do you get kids really excited about books and reading? That's what we're doing. But then, you know, speaking to you guys as technologists, there's an incredible data science problem that's going on under there, which is that in the US, you've got 33 million kids attending elementary schools. They're largely at about over 100,000 different schools. Each of those schools has different demographics, languages, price points, racial profiles. The schools are not all the same. And so how do you take data and what kids are interested in, what they're buying, and deliver books that are going to really drive engagement? Some schools, I talked to a librarian yesterday afternoon and I'm like, what's good in the library? What's going on? And she's like, man, graphic novels are saving my life at this school because they love them. They can't get enough. And so it's okay, if you're at a school like that and graphic novels are working, we got to send you the best ones. Like, how do we get those to you? How do we get you more of those so that books and reading becomes something that kids associate with their identity from the earliest ages and the earliest grades? And I think it's that intrinsic love that we're really trying to work on.
I love that. Now, I won't share any of your numbers because you are a private company, but you've built a real business and you've successfully raised capital from top investors, from Felicis, Owen Moxie, obviously, Shasta, a bunch of great angel investors as well. You've also hired an incredible team. And so much about venture, I think it's really a talent business. You're hiring incredible, talented people like you, who in turn hire the best of the best as a CFO, as a head of product, as a head of engineering. You've done all of that. Since we have so many investors who listen to the pod, if you could share any high level, obviously nothing specific, you know, high level growth rates or projections going forward, why is this a space that investors should be paying attention to?
It's certainly a contrarian investment, right? And so sometimes the best investments are, you just never know where growth or inspiration is going to come from. And our early investors really said that to us. You know, my first check-in was from a a very prominent investor. And I sat down with him and I explained all the ideas and things I was contemplating. And he said to me, I'm just going to stop there, because he's like, the idea doesn't matter. The idea is going to change a million times. The only thing that matters at the stage that you're at is the team. And I was just actually talking to O1A the other night, and we were having a fascinating conversation about this, of how important is the TAM like to these, you know, early investments or whatever. And we were having this debate back and forth, and they were like, you know, should I invest in this company? I think their TAM is a little small. And we were just like, a great team can overcome a small TAM and find the next frontier. So you're right, it is a talent business, and we have achieved real scale. And I think there's nothing about the idea that would have made anybody jump out of their shoes. Certainly from where we were starting, we got a lot of no's, and we got a lot of come back when you have some traction and it's too early for us, you know, and all the, we're not excited about the category and all the traditional, I think, things that you hear. But I think there was a certain cohort of early investors that knew the team, knew the people on the team. And they were just like, we're going to see what happens, because it's kind of interesting that you guys are building in books. Because setting a good product and tech team into that category where there's not a ton of other product and tech teams operating, that could be interesting. And so I think it is the team.
Jess, you mentioned this a couple times, something about a data science product. When I think about your background, and then I think back to what I guess this was said probably in the mid-90s, where Jeff Bezos would say that your margin is my opportunity. When I think about what you guys are doing, is that you're bringing that aspect of discoverability and curation, which is a huge problem across almost every digital business when you think about it, right? And so Amazon's already gotten down what they do really well, and no one's going to compete with them on that front. But as I think of so many different digital verticals, I think about what you're doing and applying data science, but also like this kind of love and this mission driven thing. Talk to us about, okay, fine, we know what the book TAM is and this and that, whatever, but what is the TAM working with schools to kind of achieve the mission that you're setting out to do? Because that's not something I think like at Amazon or many e-commerce companies are too focused on. So talk to us a little bit about those opportunities, and how do you guys make money? Who do you partner with? You're paving a sort of new path, it seems like, for something, for an industry that a lot of folks have become really comfortable with. We know what it's like to order a book online, and we know what it's like to go into a big bookstore and try to search for something. And that is an experience in and of itself that will not go away, because 20 years ago, people were saying the bookstore is going away. And I don't know about you guys, my kids still love going into them. I still like going into them. So to me, I think there's room for lots of different players in the space.
I think that we are squarely focused on schools. Like, we see schools as the vehicle to come in and make an impact. And how do we make money? We are a fundraiser for the school. So the school hosts the book fair. The book fair has changed slightly from when we were kids. It now has an online component to it. So there's an online fair and the offline fair. If you're in elementary school, I mean, honestly, this is one of the most exciting times of the year. It's when your library or your cafeteria turns into a bookstore, and it's a bookstore that's brought to you. And so the question of like, how engaging and exciting can we make that? I have zero doubt that events platform and that go to market. Parents and kids are some of the hardest and most expensive audience for brands to reach today. And so I think, without sharing too much of where we're going, because there's some things coming down the pipe that aren't quite launched yet, I think we're thinking, how big can this get, right? And how big can we make this, especially given there's now an online component to the fair? What else can we help parents discover? What else can support our mission? Do we move beyond books, even into other exciting things? All that support education, of course. It's just a really fascinating time. And I think Amazon's an interesting example, because I actually look at Amazon as very interesting in that they also started in books, right? That was their first category. And books are a great go-to-market vehicle. They're also a great data vehicle. Whereas if you can understand what someone's reading, you can understand their interests and a lot about what makes them tick. And I think that partnering with schools and really helping them figure out what makes each individual child, not just the school, but each individual child, what lights them up, allows us to go after sort of a much bigger opportunity and really be that educational partner that I think schools want and need.
I know we have a number of parents who listen to this pod. So if you're a parent listening, or you happen to be a teacher listening, how do you bring Literati to your school?
So we just launched this week, a few days ago, the ability to turn on our e-commerce store, our e-commerce for every classroom. So you can now, whether you're hosting a fair with us or not, you can start to test our newest product line, which is an e-commerce platform, and allow teachers to essentially raise money for their classroom by using us to sell books to parents. So any teacher now anywhere can use us. If your school does host a book fair, we're booking now for fall 2024. That's a space theme. So our fall 2024 is a galactic space theme. And then spring 2025 is the one I told you about, the story arcade, where it's a gaming theme book fair. I'm really excited about those next two themes. Those are coming up. And then of course, all parents everywhere can utilize our subscription service. So those are really the three primary ways.
All right. Well, we will be sure to put in the show notes a link to Literati, and we'll put a discount code in there. So for any of you guys who are really interested in this platform and just learning more about it and how to get your kids or possibly your school or your classroom involved, we'll put it in the show notes there. Before we get out of here, Jess, I'd love to, and this is where we're going to put Katie on the spot a little bit, love for you to kind of reflect a little bit on that relationship. Obviously, you guys go way back as former colleagues at Google. And by the way, on that pod that I listened to from 2021, Katie, and I know that you had spent some time at Yahoo Finance, but you were working at Google Finance and you had mentioned that it was Jess's idea to put moving stock charts. And I can tell you that I thank you for that, Jess, because again, back in the day, as someone who was often going to Google and checking stocks on the move, that was a pretty cool little trick that you guys did all the way back then. But talk to me a little bit about like how your relationship changed once Katie became an investor, an advisor. It seems like somebody who's been really close to you as you guys have been building out Literati. I'd love to hear a little bit about that relationship.
So yes, Katie and I first partnered to put stock quotes and embed stock quotes into the Google search results. It's a feature I still use today. And I think of you, Katie, every time I fire up a chart.
See what the stock is moving up.
Yeah, I know. And Sergey insisted that we put market cap in there. And I'm glad that we did, because that's also useful. But yeah, our relationship has evolved. She talked about how a light, she mentioned the word light in respect to me, and that's exactly how I feel about her. And Katie, I might be more of a light to you because you're a light to me. And so it's like very compounding, actually. Katie's one of these investors and people who just makes you want to be a better person. She makes you want to try harder. She's a power athlete who is like just go team player, like always in your corner. I've worked with a lot of investors and we've had a lot of ups and downs. I think that it's crazy to just think that every entrepreneurial journey is up and to the right. It's really not. It might look like that in the end, but there are big dips. And I think Katie is someone who, when things are going well, she's cheerleading, she's making introductions, she's going, how can this get bigger? And then when things are not going well, she's in the trenches with us and she's doesn't stop believing, doesn't write us off, doesn't slink off into the distance of, oh, this might be one of my ones that didn't work out. She's in it with us and is just like, how do we get back on our feet? How do we keep moving forward? How do we climb this mountain? And I think every entrepreneurial's journey is really defined by those moments where you're up against a wall and things are difficult and you're kind of squeezing through the narrows of what your customers need, what your employees need, what your investors need. They don't always line up. And just having someone like Katie who has seen it, done it, been there, just to be in it with you and listening in a non-judgmental way. And just an investor like that's invaluable. And so I think that our bond and our friendship makes that easier. But I think that's just how Katie is also.
I'm blushing. And I really appreciate you. And I know how hard building a company is. And you've got moxie, kid. And that takes courage. But just seeing you grow and seeing you thrive and seeing you build and stay true to your mission and vision and delighting so many children and customers and investors along the way, but being so customer driven is always the way to go. And so I appreciate you. I appreciate the joy and the impact that you've made in the world. And Dan, thank you for bringing us together today.
This is probably the fifth or sixth that we've done in this series. And listening to the mutual admiration, and Jess, you said it, in good times and bad, for a lot of these relationships between founders and investors has been really interesting for me to hear, because I do plenty of these sorts of pods with just an investor and I hear one side of the story, or with an entrepreneur. And so I really appreciate listening to the two of you guys talk about your history and really learning a lot about Literati. So Jess, I really appreciate you coming on the pod. Katie, thanks for coming back, and I hope we'll do this again as you reach some big milestone in Literati. So we're rooting for you, and we really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
If you like what you heard, make sure to hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. We also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com.